Sooner or later, usually sooner, anybody who proposes to write a book about H.L. Mencken finds his way to the top floor of the main branch of the Enoch Pratt Free Library in downtown Baltimore. On that floor is a room with a bright blue door, and behind that door are most of the private papers of a vain and brilliant pack rat. Mencken thought so well of himself that he started subscribing to a clipping service at the age of 23. And he preserved, for the edification of future scholars, among many, many, many other things, his school books, his doctor's bills, and all his canceled checks. 12 years ago, I walked through the door of the Mencken Room for the first time in my life. I got to know that room well during the years I spent working in it. In fact, I grew to love it. It's comfortable and quiet, like the library of a slightly shabby but distinguished club. When you're working in the Mencken Room, you're usually the only person there, which means you can hear yourself think. And if you listen closely enough, you can almost hear Mencken thinking, too. He never set foot in the Mencken Room, so far as I know, but most of his personal library is there, and nearly all his papers, and even one of his typewriters, an ancient Corona portable with the black enamel worn off the space bar from years of constant use. He probably wrote a couple of million words on that typewriter, all of them pounded out with two fingers. One of his colleagues at the Baltimore Sun described his typing style like this. He hit the keys only with his tiny forefingers and spaced with his right elbow, a routine that made him look like a bear cub imitating a drum majorette. I think I'm the first person ever to have brought a laptop computer into the Mencken Room, and I know Mencken would have disapproved of that. He told a reporter that the only modern innovations he truly appreciated were the typewriter and the Pullman sleeper car. He never flew on an airplane, and for most of his life, he never drove a car, never went to the movies, never listened to the radio, and used the telephone as seldom as possible. I shudder to think what he would have thought of email. One afternoon, I was sitting with my laptop in the Mencken Room, transcribing a column Mencken wrote for the Baltimore Sun, in which he talked about religion. He was against it. It had been raining for the past couple of days, and though I didn't know it, there was a leak in the roof of the library, and water had been silently dripping into a chandelier hanging over my head. I was clicking away on my laptop, inputting an especially agnostic paragraph. I wish I could remember what it was, but I swear I'm not making this story up. Just as I typed the last words, the hollow brass ball on the bottom of the chandelier came unstuck and fell to the table, 6 inches from the laptop and a foot from my head, spilling dirty rainwater all over my papers. I've never been able to decide who did that, Mencken or God. Not only can you feel Mencken's presence in the Mencken Room, you can also read what tens of thousands of other people have had to say about him. The Mencken collection includes more than 200 scrapbooks containing every newspaper and magazine article written about H.L. Mencken since 1903. The earliest clippings were dated and pasted into those books by Mencken himself. I've read them all, or at least laid eyes on every page, which isn't quite the same thing. Still, I probably know as much about what other people thought of Mencken and wrote about him as anybody alive. One thing I've noticed is that since 1956, the year he died, an amazingly high percentage of the clippings in the scrapbooks are what I call MWATs. That's my personal acronym for If Mencken Were Alive Today, MWAT. It's a literary form as strict as a sonnet. First, the author describes some current outrage against common sense, and then, in quick succession, he imagines the scalding things Mencken might have had to say about it, cites a few other recent and similar offenses, suggests the world would be a better place, MWAT, and then closes by remarking that no modern-day newspaper would dare hire so politically incorrect a columnist. I saw a perfect example of an MWAT a couple of months ago. It was the first paragraph of the Washington Post's review of my book, The Skeptic. It was written by Richard Lingeman, Theodore Dreiser's biographer, and Mr. Lingeman wrote, "What if, by some devilish miracle, the great 1920s iconoclast H.L. Mencken were resurrected and writing today? Who'd be the targets of his cynical wit? Jerry Falwell? John Ashcroft? Ken Lay and the Enron gang? George W. Bush? Oh well, It's a pleasant thought. And there you have it, the quintessence of MWatt. What interests me most about all these MWatts is that their authors all take the same thing for granted, which is that their readers know what they're talking about, that they know who Mencken was and what he wrote like. And that, when you think about it, is quite a remarkable assumption. Kenneth Tynan, the British drama critic, once paid a lovely tribute to Noel Coward. He said, even the youngest of us will know, in 50 years' time, exactly what we mean by a very Noel Coward sort of person. Tynan wrote those words exactly 50 years ago, and sure enough, he was right. We do. Well, H.L. Mencken died 47 years ago, the week before I was born, as a matter of fact. And today, a half century later, you really can take it for granted that most literate Americans will know just what you mean by a very H.L. Mencken sort of essay. What they'll probably have in mind is something like, oh, maybe The Husbandman, a little editorial about the American farmer that Mencken wrote for the third issue of the American Mercury, the magazine he co-founded in 1924. This is how that essay starts. Let the farmer, so far as I am concerned, be damned forevermore. To hell with him, and bad luck to him. He is a tedious fraud and ignoramus, a cheap rogue and hypocrite, the eternal jack of the human pack. He deserves all that he ever suffers under our economic system and more. Any city man, not insane, who sheds tears for him is shedding tears of the crocodile. See what I mean? Nobody else could have written that paragraph, and anybody who knows anything about American literature would have guessed who wrote it. It isn't hard. Mencken's style, the cut of his jib, is as personal as a fingerprint. Here's what another famous author had to say about that style. Mencken's vigor is astonishing. It is like an electric current. In all he writes, there is a crackle of blue sparks, like those one sees in a dynamo house amongst revolving masses of metal that give you a sense of enormous hidden power. For that is what he has. Who could quarrel with such generosity, such vibrating sympathy, and with a mind so intensely alive? That, too, is a wonderful tribute. And do you know who said it? Joseph Conrad. That is what the author of Heart of Darkness thought of the author of In Defense of Women. And it reminds us of something we too easily forget. H.L. Mencken is not our contemporary. We forget that because he sounds so very contemporary, not just in tone, but quite often in subject matter as well. As in, say, this little rhapsody about the American politician, written in 1926. He is a man who has lied and dissembled, and a man who has crawled. He knows the taste of the boot polish. He has suffered kicks in the tonneau of his pantaloons. He has taken orders from his superiors in knavery, and he has wooed and flattered his inferiors in sense. His public life is an endless series of evasions and false pretenses. He is willing to embrace any issue, however idiotic, that will get him votes. And he is willing to sacrifice any principle, however sound, that will lose them for him. I do not describe the Democratic politician at his inordinate worst. I describe him as he is encountered in the full sunshine of normalcy. He may be, on the one hand, a crossroads idler, striving to get into the state legislature by grace of the local mortgage sharks and evangelical clergy, or he may be, on the other, the President of the United States. It is almost an axiom that no man may make a career in politics in the Republic without stooping to such ignobility. It is as necessary as a loud voice. Any number of pieces that Mencken wrote about his favorite subjects, big government, religious fundamentalists, censorship, America at war, could be reprinted without change on the op-ed page of tomorrow morning's paper and still sound utterly relevant. And yet, it is an illusion. For we are as far removed from the world of Mencken's youth as he was from the world of George Washington. Remember, he was born in 1880, 10 months before Billy the Kid was shot, the same year Edison invented the electric light bulb. Melville, Emerson, and Longfellow were all still alive in 1880. So were Darwin and Marx. Mark Twain was at work on Huckleberry Finn, Henry James on The Portrait of a Lady. Winston Churchill was 5 years old. Calvin Coolidge, 8. Stravinsky, Picasso, Franklin Roosevelt, and Hitler had not yet been born. And, of course, Queen Victoria was still on her throne. Everybody who knew Mencken best said he was a perfect Victorian, and it was nothing more than the truth, both figurative and literal, for he finished his schooling, went to work, and began to publish before the close of the 19th century. He was a man entirely of his time and place. And if we fail to remember that most important of facts, we will fail altogether to understand H.L. Mencken. In particular, we will fail to understand his flaws. If, for example, we call him a racist, as so many have not unreasonably done, we are nevertheless forgetting where and when he was born and raised. In Baltimore, Maryland, 15 years after Lincoln was shot, and just 3 years after the last federal troops of occupation were pulled out of the South, bringing Reconstruction to an end. The surprising thing is not that Mencken said and wrote unpleasant things about blacks, but that he unhesitatingly published black authors like James Weldon Johnson and George Schuyler in the American Mercury, and even dined with them at his own dinner table in Baltimore. Now, I would never dream of whitewashing Mencken, not in any sense of the word. Some of the things he wrote for publication are appalling, and some of the things he wrote in his diary, most especially about Jews, are even worse. One of the things I went out of the way to do in my book was to rub your nose in the worst of Mencken so that you can more fairly measure that against the best. And I will do that here this afternoon. I will read to you what I think to be the most odious paragraph Mencken ever wrote. A private memo, not for publication, probably written in 1945 or 46, and preserved in a file in the closet of the Mencken room. He wrote, "I find it difficult to work up any regret for the heroes butchered in World War II. Anyone silly enough to believe in such transparent quacks as Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill leaves the world little the loser by departing from it." That is dreadful, and we must not turn our faces from it. But at the same time, we mustn't turn our faces from the other side of Mencken. Not long after his diary was published and triggered an avalanche of hostile criticism, there appeared a letter in the New York Review of Books. It said, "We wish to express our dismay at the overreaction to the diary of H.L. Mencken. The diary does indeed contain discourteous remarks about Jews and blacks. It also contains discourteous remarks about most races, nations, and professions. Whatever Mencken's prejudices, the word he himself used to describe his essays, he was a tremendous liberating force in American culture and should be so celebrated and remembered." This letter was signed by, among others, Norman Mailer, Arthur Miller, William Styron, Kurt Vonnegut, and Ralph Ellison. Those men did not need to be reminded of what Mencken did. They grew up knowing it. In 1950, Edmund Wilson called Mencken, without question, since Poe, our greatest practicing literary journalist. If anything, that was an understatement. At the age of 24, Mencken wrote the very first book ever published about George Bernard Shaw anywhere in the world. He was mainly responsible for bringing Joseph Conrad, Theodore Dreiser, Sinclair Lewis, and Friedrich Nietzsche to the attention of American readers. As co-editor of The Smart Set and co-founder of the American Mercury, he published the early work of Willa Cather, William Faulkner, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Eugene O'Neill, Ezra Pound, and even James Joyce. In his spare time, he produced The American Language, the pioneering study of the divergence of British and American English. He also launched three pulp magazines, including Black Mask, the cradle of the hard-boiled mystery story. He wrote a best-selling autobiographical trilogy. He compiled a fat dictionary of quotations, one so good that a day rarely passes without my looking up something in it. And Mencken was far more than just a literary man. As a working newspaper reporter, he covered everything from the Scopes evolution trial to the 1948 presidential conventions, the first ones ever to be televised. He more or less invented the modern op-ed column. As a social critic, He led the charge against the pseudo-Puritanism of Prohibition-era American culture and became world famous for his knockabout assaults on the manners and morals of what he called, in his best-known coinage, the Bible Belt. When he died, one headline writer summed him up in five neat words: Mencken, critic of all, dies. Simply to call him our greatest practicing literary journalist, though true enough, is beside the point. Mencken was great America's greatest journalist, period. 14 years after the publication of The Diary of H.L. Mencken, he is still at the center of the American cultural conversation. Most of his major books are in print, and new collections of his essays continue to be published, read, and quoted. Last year, Judge Richard Posner brought out a book in which he surfed the web to see which public intellectuals had been most frequently cited there between 1995 and 2000. Mencken was the sixth most cited dead intellectual. Fewer times than Bernard Shaw, George Orwell, H.G. Wells, Timothy Leary, or C.S. Lewis, but more times than W.H. Auden, Bertolt Brecht, Allen Ginsberg, John Maynard Keynes, Lillian Hellman, Marshall McLuhan, Ayn Rand, or Jean-Paul Sartre. And, if I may put on my pop culture hat for a moment, Mencken actually turned up on TV back last fall on an episode of the WB sitcom Gilmore Girls. A friend of mine happened to be watching that night and informed me of this staggering phenomenon. One of the characters on the show says, "I have a surprise. Not only did I find that copy of Mencken's Chrestomathy that we discussed, I also found a first edition of his memoirs as well. It's in my office if you'd like to see them." And his granddaughter replies, "Oh my God, I totally would." Now, I ask you, how many other major American writers have been anointed as totally cool by the WB? More to the point, what other American journalist of the 20s continues to be not only read, but relished? Just one. But why is it, the door is locked, so if somebody wants to get in, you should let them in. But why is it that we still wonder what Mencken would think if he were alive today? Why does it still matter to us what he wrote about Franklin and Teddy Roosevelt and Calvin Coolidge and William Jennings Bryan? Part of the reason, maybe the biggest part, is that he was mainly interested not in individual politicians or even in politics as such, but in the American national character. For Mencken, America was a land in which Puritanism is constantly at war with hedonism, and analogously, collectivism with individualism. And his great achievement as a social critic was to isolate and dramatize this struggle in a permanently memorable way. Mencken's hatred of Puritanism, and hatred is not too strong a word, it's the word he used, is at the heart of his critique of American life. He once spoke of the whole Puritan scheme of things, with its gross and nauseating hypocrisies, its idiotic theologies, its moral obsessions, its pervasive Philistinism. All these things he took to be intrinsic to America's collective personality. Theologies and ideologies come and go, but the conceptions of human nature from which they spring are forever with us, and to leaf through Mencken's work is to be struck by how often, as he bashed away at long-forgotten manifestations of the Puritan culture of the 20s, he said things scarcely less applicable, though in a very different way, to America today, like this. "In the United States, there is a right way to think and a wrong way to think in everything, not only in theology or politics or economics, but in the most trivial matters of everyday life. Thus, in the average American city, the citizen who, in the face of an organized public clamor for the erection of, say, an equestrian statue of Susan B. Anthony in front of the chief railway station, or the purchase of a dozen leopards for the municipal zoo, or the dispatch of an invitation to the Structural Iron Workers Union to hold its next annual convention in the town symphony hall, the citizen who, for any logical reason, opposes such a proposal on the ground, say, that Miss Anthony never rode a horse in her life, or that a dozen leopards would be less useful than a gallows to hang the city council, or that the structural iron workers would spit all over the floor of Symphony Hall and knock down the busts of Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, this citizen is commonly denounced as an anarchist and a public enemy, It is not only erroneous to think such, it has come to be immoral. I should add that he wrote those words in 1921. Mencken's war against the Puritans of his day is what his liberal admirers have in mind when they argue that he should be celebrated as a liberating force in American culture. Nowhere has this belief been explained more dramatically or more relevantly than in the pages of Richard Wright's great autobiography, Black Boy. Mencken's own copy of Black Boy can be found on the shelves of the Mencken Room. I looked at it a few years ago, and as I held it in my hand, I saw that Mencken himself had marked in the margin this passage from the last chapter in which Richard Wright remembers the first time he ever dared to check out a book from the public library in Memphis, Tennessee. A block away from the library, I opened one of Mencken's books and read a title, A Book of Prefaces. I was nearing my 19th birthday, and I did not know how to pronounce the word preface. I thumbed the pages and saw strange words and strange names. I shook my head, disappointed. I looked at the other book. It was called Prejudices. I knew what that word meant. I had heard it all my life, and right off I was on guard. That night, in my rented room, while letting the hot water run over my can of pork and beans in the sink, I opened A Book of Prefaces and began to read. I was jarred and shocked by the style, the clear, clean, sweeping sentences. Why did he write like that? And how did one write like that? He was using words as a weapon, using them as one would use a club. Could words be weapons? Well, yes, for here they were. Then maybe, perhaps, I could use them as a weapon? No, it frightened me. I read on, and what amazed me was not what he said, but how on earth anybody had the courage to say it. To me, the point Richard Wright is trying to make here is that Mencken's liberating force is less a function of his particular convictions than of the firmly balanced prose rhythms and vigorous diction in which they were couched. It was, in short, a triumph of style and also of charm. We often forget the charm, though it's central to his appeal. Only a very charming man could have written, as Mencken did, an epitaph for himself that went like this. If, after I depart this veil, you ever remember me and have thought to please my ghost, forgive some sinner and wink your eye at some homely girl. As actors like to say, he is present in his writings, talking to you across the table, chomping on one of those foul 5-cent cigars he loved to chew. And because of this, his writing inspires real affection among those who respond to its vigor and panache. That's why everybody who likes Mencken seems to have a favorite Mencken essay, and wishes I'd quoted it more extensively in my book. For some, it is the Sahara of the Beaux-Arts, the piece in which Mencken carved up the cultural pretensions of the American South. For others, it's In Memoriam, WJB, the scalding obituary of William Jennings Bryan, written a few days after the Scopes trial ended. As for me, I've read too much Mencken to have just one favorite essay, or even one that I think is most exemplary of his style, but if I absolutely had to pick one piece of his for an anthology of American writing, I would be tempted to choose the essay he called, appropriately enough, On Being an American. It's one of his most spectacular displays of verbal fireworks, and a comprehensive indictment of American culture to boot. This is the passage I like best. Here in America, the general average of intelligence, of knowledge, of competence, of integrity, of self-respect, of honor, is so low that any man who knows his trade, does not fear ghosts, has read 50 good books, and practices the common decencies, stands out as brilliantly as a wart on a bald head, and is thrown willy-nilly into a meager and exclusive aristocracy. And here, more than anywhere else that I know of or have heard of, the daily panorama of human existence, of private and communal folly, the unending procession of governmental extortions and chicaneries, of commercial brigandages and throat slittings, of theological buffooneries, of aesthetic ribaldries, of legal swindles and harlotries, of miscellaneous rogueries, villainies, imbecilities, grotesqueries, and extravagances, is so inordinately gross and preposterous, so perfectly brought up to the highest conceivable amperage, so steadily enriched with an almost fabulous daring and originality, that only the man who was born with a petrified diaphragm can fail to laugh himself to sleep every night and to wake every morning with all the eager, unflagging expectation of a Sunday school superintendent touring the Paris peep shows. All of Mencken is in that passage, and you can hear exactly what Richard Wright meant. He sweeps the reader along from one outrageous assertion to the next, his high emotion transformed into high comedy by the exaggeration, the startling use of incongruous words, the long chains of blunt nouns that send the reader tumbling down a boiling torrent of gusto, only to slam headlong at the end into a burlesque metaphor. But H.L. Mencken was something more than a memorable stylist, if something less than a truly wise man. However perverse or excessive his underlying ideas may be, they retain to this day much of their impelling force. And no matter whether you agree with him about anything at all, you can't help being impressed by the stubborn way in which Mencken, the self-made philosopher, grapples in his unpretentious, take-no-prisoners style with the permanent things, the limits of art, the rule of law, the meaning of life. This simplicity, one comes to realize, is inseparable from the message. In Mencken, style and content are one, and the resulting alloy is more than merely individual. It is a matchlessly exact expression of the American temper. In 1930, Mencken was invited to contribute his personal credo to a symposium whose other participants included Albert Einstein, John Dewey, H.G. Wells, and Bertrand Russell. Being a journalist, and thus accustomed to writing short, he got the whole of it into these three crisp sentences. I believe that it is better to tell the truth than to lie. I believe that it is better to be free than to be a slave. And I believe that it is better to know than to be ignorant. It is a credo without shadows or second thoughts. No one but an American, and no other American, could have written it. In the 12 years since I started working on my book, people have asked me, time and again, two questions. Now, the first question is, how long is your book, Mr. Teachout? And that's probably because I was imprudent enough to write a piece for the New York Times Book Review back in 1995, in which I declared for all the world to hear that literary biographies had just gotten too damn long. While I was at it, I threw in the following suggestion, just for good measure. Biographers who publish books in excess of 500 pages after previously complaining in print that biographies are too long should be sentenced to the pillory for not less than 30 minutes nor more than 90. You can imagine my relief when I got back my page proofs last spring and saw that The Skeptic was 411 pages long. Now the other question is a little trickier. A great many people have asked me something like this. 10 years is a lot of time to spend with anybody, especially a guy like Mencken. Do you still like him? Do you still admire him? Or did you get sick and tired of him? Well, I never got tired of him, though sometimes I got angry with him. Sometimes I asked myself, how could a man so smart have thought so many stupid things? How could he have been so terribly wrong about Jews, about blacks, about World War II? And I don't have a simple answer to that question. People write books to answer questions like that, and The Skeptic is my answer, insofar as there is an answer. Do I still like him? Yes, I do, basically. I would have been very glad to have dinner with him, though I'm not sure I would have wanted to read what he wrote about me in his diary afterwards. For he was a fearfully complicated man, both cold and loving, opportunistic and loyal, foolish and wise, much like the rest of us, only more so. But as for admiring him, the answer is simpler. Not everything about H.L. Mencken was admirable. Some things about him were frightful. Sometimes he's hard to take. Yet there's no getting around him. He is a fact of American life. He was, to the first part of the 20th century, what Mark Twain was the last part of the 19th, the quintessential voice of American letters. In the city of his birth, he's known as the Sage of Baltimore, a nickname at which I have no doubt he would have smiled. But then, perhaps he was a sage of sorts, though a completely American one, not calm and reflective, but as noisy as a tornado, witty and abrasive, self-confident and self-contradictory, sometimes maddening, often engaging, always inimitable. Definitely a man to have dinner with, and a writer to read for as long as books are read. Thank you.